Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Our guest speaker tonight is Dr. Janda Gooding. She's head of the photographs, film and sound section at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. And prior to that, Dr. Gooding was a senior curator of art at the memorial. And from 1979 to 2005, she was a creator of the Art Gallery of Western Australia. She's the author of 8 books and the winner of numerous awards and prizes. But she's addressing the Sydney Institute tonight on the occasion of her most recent book, Gallipoli Revisited, in the footsteps of Charles Bean and the Australian Historical Mission. And the topic of Dr. Gooding's book is the topic of her talk at the Sydney Institute tonight. Dr. Gooding, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here and also to be able to speak on one of my favourite topics, which is about museums and the collections that are formed for them. The book, Gallipoli Revisited, traces the work of the Australian Historical Mission that went to Gallipoli in 1919. The Historical Mission was very much a group driven by a shared sense of responsibility to document and record the landscape and history of Gallipoli for Australians. I have to say at the outset, my interest is not with the military history of Gallipoli, although we know that is a subject of immense interest and one that remains topical. My interest is with the images produced by the mission, and in particular the photographs taken by George Hubert Wilkins and the paintings and sketches made by George Washington Lambert. It is this body of work that forms the core of the nation's official pictorial collection related to Gallipoli. Central to the work of Lambert and Wilkins was the foresight and drive of Charles Bean, a man who looms large in any discussion about Australia's involvement in the First World War. Charles Bean was appointed in 1914 to be Australia's first official war correspondent. Subsequently, he was asked to write the official history of Australia's part in the war. He therefore has a very firm grip on the official story of Anzac as we know it. Bean was also a founder of one of the best known museums in Australia, the Australian War Memorial. So he is someone I have a great interest in. Bean's role as official correspondent was to cover the contribution of Australian soldiers to the war, to report to the government of the day, and to make his press articles available to a wide range of Australian newspapers. He lived and worked alongside the fighting troops from October 1914 to the armistice of November 1918. In fact, he was truly an embedded journalist. He spent nearly the entire campaign on Gallipoli, landing with Australian headquarters staff at about 10 a.m. on the 25th of April. And he evacuated with the troops about 8 months later. His capacity to make connections with officers and eventually move with ease among the regular troops ensured he had access to the highest commanders, as well as regular troops serving in the trenches. Bean had a unique opportunity to record first-hand experiences of Australians suddenly thrust into a European war, and he was well aware that it was a privileged position with great responsibility. While on Gallipoli, Bean spent most of his time running between headquarters and the trenches, interviewing men about the battles they'd fought in, and working until late at night writing up his notes. He took hundreds of photographs. He collected objects of personal importance to himself. For example, he carried a reminder of a lucky escape, a piece of shell that had exploded on the top of his dugout. Of course, his urge to document what was going on around him and to collect things was not unique to him. But it was during his time on Gallipoli that he became convinced that Australia should create a great museum that would stand as a tribute to the efforts of the Australian Imperial Forces. With so many dying around him, he also considered it his personal duty to build as accurate a record as possible of the events that were happening. In late 1915, as Bean made his last rounds to the various outposts and the troops prepared to evacuate Gallipoli, he wrote in his diary of watching Australians, lovingly tending the graves of their fallen mates. A few days later, from the deck of the HMS Grafton, he kept an all-night vigil as the troops quietly withdrew, noting the time of every sound and every movement on the shore, the bombs going off along the ridgelines, and the occasional firing across the lines by the last troops. The night was full of anxiety, but Bean's accounts are tinged with melancholy as the familiar posts and ridges were gradually abandoned. As he wrote his last few notes in the dark, he observed that perhaps the greatest successes we have achieved here is quietly giving it to them without their knowing. Explaining Australia's part in the Great War was to become Bean's life's work. And over the next 3 years, as he tramped across the Western Front following Australians, he worked tirelessly to gather as much information as possible about their experiences. His work, and indeed his influence, went far beyond that of a regular journalist. A very brief summary of some of his key achievements during the war years hardly does him justice. Firstly, he saw the need for Australians to keep their own military records. And to do this, he established the Australian War Records Section, a unit that systematically collected war diaries, official correspondence and documents, and personal accounts. Secondly, Bean lobbied very hard and argued for Australia to be able to collect the most relevant war relics, as he called them, from the battlefields. These would be essential components of the future National Museum that he envisaged. And thirdly, Bean helped to establish the official war art and the official war photography schemes that employed artists such as Arthur Streeton and George Lambert, and photographers Frank Hurley and Hubert Wilkins. This scheme still operates today. All this while spending most of his days moving around the trenches and front lines, dodging bullets and shells, and witnessing the most appalling carnage in what he called the giant mincing machine of war. Barry? However, the events at Anzac were always at the back of his mind. When Australian forces had abandoned Gallipoli in December 1915, many details of the campaign remained unclear, and indeed some things would prove just to be unknowable. Record keeping had been inadequate, and official documents were later described as scrappy and insufficient to prepare a detailed military history. Bean felt compelled to try to resolve many of the questions that remained about the Anzac campaign. Who had gone farthest inland on the first day? What had really happened when those four lines of light horsemen had charged across the neck? And crucially, what had the Turks seen from their positions? These and many other questions had plagued the men during 1915, and still remain to be investigated in 1918, when, with the end of the war, it became possible to visit the old Anzac area. The day after Germany signed the armistice that ended the war, Charles Bean was back in London to get formal approval to return to Australia via Gallipoli. He asked permission to take an artist and a photographer to help him record and document the landscape. For him, visual records were going to be absolutely critical to help Australians visualise where their troops had fought. And with about a third of all Australians who died on Gallipoli having no known grave, pictures would help to symbolically locate those missing bodies in a natural landscape. Bean called the group he assembled the Australian Historical Mission, using a quasi-religious term that perhaps indicated an intention to fulfil his obligations to the dead. Certainly, as he said, the return to Gallipoli gave him a chance to pay homage to the Anzac dead and to use their faith and fire to inspire his fellow Australians to national greatness. Bean selected highly experienced men to accompany him. As photographer, he chose George Hubert Wilkins, the official war photographer with whom he had worked very closely on the Western Front for the last 18 months. Wilkins had demonstrated to Bean his commitment to making as truthful a photographic record as possible, and his personal bravery under the most extreme conditions had been acknowledged by a military cross with a bar. The artist chosen was George Washington Lambert, who had already served as an official war artist with the Light Horse in Egypt, Palestine and the Sinai in early 1918. He had delivered an impressive array of paintings, sketches and pencil portraits when he returned to London. And Charles Bean was very keen for Lambert to paint at least two large battle paintings for the new museum. The group departed from London on the 18th of January 1919. Bean was travelling with men he knew and trusted, and the photographs and works of art they made during the expedition would form the nucleus of the official collection. After travelling across southern Europe, the historical mission reached Gallipoli in early February 1919. The Australian Historical Mission spent just over 3 weeks on Gallipoli in early 1919, and it's worth remembering that this was a place that had been abandoned by Anzac forces 3 years earlier. There had been few opportunities in 1915 to bury bodies, due to the rugged terrain and the intensity and closeness of the fighting. And during the intervening years, the site had been scavenged thoroughly by marauding dogs. Human remains were everywhere, and it was a real mess. An Australian Graves unit had arrived only a month before the mission and was doing its best to locate Australian bodies, identify them, and then reinter them in marked graves. But the work was really appalling, and the sad and melancholy atmosphere of the place affected everyone. Next slide. The historical mission spent most of its days crisscrossing the battlefields, making sketches, taking notes, drafting maps, and taking a large number of photographs. Relics of the fighting were picked up, documented, and packed for shipment to Australia. Wilkins worked alongside Charles Bean, photographing places that Bean noted as important to Australia's military history. Wilkins used a large camera that took delicate glass plates. It was cumbersome and certainly not very sophisticated by today's standards, but it produced beautiful and highly detailed images. The photographic record was intended to document the marks and evidence that remained on the landscape, so it was essential that the images be as accurate as possible. By locating an event or an object in an actual landscape, Wilkins' photographs provided supporting evidence for Bean's historical interpretation. His theory was that once people could see where something happened, they might more easily understand how it had happened. To achieve images that served this purpose, Wilkins made his compositions pretty straightforward, with the focus of attention usually in the centre. This helps to make the photographs easily understandable, and this is exactly what Bean wanted for the official record. Images that viewers could trust as reliable documentary records. They would be, as Bean said, a sacred record standing for future generations to see forever the plain, simple truth. This is a photograph of Quinn's Post, and you can see here the proximity of the fighting lines. The deep gullies and steep ridges that seem to fold into each other are here even more compressed than elsewhere. Here the Turkish trenches adjoined those of the Australians. In 1915, this area had changed hands a number of times, eventually remaining a position from which Turkish snipers covered the Australians. The photograph taken by Wilkins was taken from the Turkish perspective, looking back across Australian lines to indicate the clear view a sniper would have had of Australian positions, and these include the head of Monash Gully, Russell's Top, Coates Hill and Queen's Post. This sort of viewpoint is replicated in what seems a very simple but indeed a very powerful and evocative image of a British sniper's position on Rhododendron Ridge. Wilkins' camera was placed where the sniper would have been hiding. The photograph shows the spiky bushes on either side that constricted the view so as to give only a glimpse of the Turkish positions across the valley. A shallow depression in the soil marks where the sniper may have lain in wait, and it's easy to imagine him peering across the narrow gap, anxiously watching for movement. Further evidence of the sniper's trade is clearly visible with the spent 303 cartridge cases lying in the depression. Human bones lying on the surface of the landscape were more tangible markers of trauma, and these became an important motive in Wilkins' work. The brief ceasefire on the 24th of May 1915 had allowed the bodies of some men to be buried. But those who had been killed in no man's land during the rest of the campaign lay where they fell until the Graves unit started its gruesome work. When the historical mission arrived, several hastily filled in Turkish mass graves had been eroded by recent rain, and the bones exposed to the elements and the wild dogs. One of these pits was on the southernmost end of Anzac, near Lean's Trench, where the Turks had repeatedly tried to break the Australian line. The bleached bones could be seen a mile away as a broad white streak running down the ravine. The photographic record that Wilkins made on Gallipoli in 1919 was intended to provide visual evidence of the military events of 1915 and to support the historical narrative that Charles Bean was developing. Even though nature had started to reclaim the scarred earth and the trenches were being eroded, the signs of battle were still everywhere. Wilkins' Gallipoli photographs stand as an eyewitness account of the traces of battle that remained on the landscape. Importantly, they locate individual objects and stories and the work of the historical mission within a specific landscape. In addition, these photographs were part of the primary resources being gathered for the planned official histories and would be used in a range of publications produced by the Australian government during the interwar years. The photographs were also available for purchase by the Australian public, and they needed, as Charles Bean always highlighted, to be scrupulously accurate as a photographic record of the campaign. being the belief that the work of the Australian official photographers should have proper regard for the great sacrifices and the sacred memory of the great men to whose bravery these pictures should be a monument. In fact, all of the material collected by the Historical Mission was intended to serve as a memorial to Australia's involvement in the First World War. Apart from later developing and then printing up his plates, Wilkins' work was pretty well done when he left Gallipoli. For the artist, his work was only just beginning, and with the commissions for the very large studio paintings, it would continue for some years. While on Gallipoli, though, Lambert needed to capture the light, atmosphere and feel of the place. The small oil sketches he produced on the spot served as memory notes, and if you haven't seen them, they're about this big. These memory notes reminded him of the colour, light and character of the landscape, but they were finished paintings in their own right and not studies for the large battle pictures. Lambert sketched and painted directly onto small wood panels, often allowing the wood grain to remain as part of his composition. The weather was bleak and cold, and there was even a substantial snowfall when they arrived. Lambert's hands and fingers were frozen, and yet he still produced such extraordinarily fine work. This is one of the first paintings he worked on, the Sphinx from Pluggey's Plateau, the site of intense fighting on the morning of the 25th of April. Perched high on a precipice in cold and windy weather, Lambert painted the razor edges of sandy clay that lead up to the distinctive peak of the Sphinx. A main priority for Lambert was that he should make all elements of his paintings as authentic as possible. He was aware that veterans of Gallipoli would expect the details to be right, and to achieve this, he would get up at dawn to get the effects of the dawn light, or if an event had happened in the evening, he would paint as late as possible. With such a determination for truthfulness in his work, it was always a great disappointment to him that the mission visited Gallipoli in February and not April. Painting up at the neck, a fierce wind forced him to work very quickly, and he lay in areas of sky, ground and churned earth where the trenches still remained. This was the place where four successive lines of Australian men had charged across the narrow stretch of no man's land, only to be met with a perfect sheet of flame cut down by Turkish machine gun fire. The melancholy mood is accentuated by a lone soldier looking across the narrow field, and at his feet, a skull and a human thigh bone poke out of the earth. Lambert's insistence for authenticity was absolutely paramount. On the 6th of March, he rose before dawn so as to synchronise this painting session at Lone Pine with the same time of the charge of the Light Horse Brigade at the Neck in August 1915. He had the right light for the painting. The difference in 1919 was, of course, that the ground was still littered with human bones that stood out white in the early morning light. He commented to his wife that the worst feature of this after-battle work is that the silent hills and valleys sit stern, unmoved, callous of the human, and busy only in growing bush and sliding earth to hide the scars left by the war disease. And it's like... The same silent hills and valleys confronted him when he travelled south, down the peninsula to Cape Helles, where he painted Archibarber from Tommy's Trench. The vegetation was different. The colours were muted, and there were greys and greens and sage browns. Lambert's mood was sombre, and made more so by the plenitude of bones that provided physical evidence of the huge loss of life in the area. He said, The dead, or rather their bones, spoil it, of course, and the melancholy is ready for him who lets his thoughts wander. Finding the place sad, yet very beautiful, he wrote to his wife as he was leaving Gallipoli, "I cannot tell you how pleased I am at getting clear of this graveyard, beautiful as it is, nor can I explain how satisfied I am to have done the work I have done." It was estimated that about 8 tons of relics were secured by the historical mission for the museum, and you can see some of them being loaded onto wagons for shipment. 26 ammunition boxes contained small items collected from the battlefields. Strands of barbed wire, busted up mess tins, badges, buttons, colour patches, shell cases, pieces of tunic and the like. 2 large cases contained more substantial objects and a selection of timbers that had been used at Lone Pine. Other items, such as the 2 abandoned lifeboats, were retrieved at a later date. Lambert's fieldwork produced just over 30 small paintings, watercolours and drawings. The photographic material created by the mission was comprehensive. Hubert Wilkins took about 200 images, and Bean's own photographs numbered 95, of which 30 were taken while the historical mission travelled through Turkey down to Egypt, where it disbanded. In addition, Bean filled 7 notebooks with topographical sketch maps and detailed diary entries, took extensive shorthand notes of interviews he conducted with veterans of the Gallipoli campaign. Maps were made on the spot, and those gathered from other sources and checked against the landscape added another layer of intricate knowledge of the land across which Australians had fought. Of course, this massive collection did end up in the War Museum that Charles Bean helped found. So I'd just like to spend a couple of minutes illustrating how this material was put to use in the years immediately after the war. Charles Bean was very particular about how he arranged his working material, and most of it was indexed and cross-referenced. Once back in Australia in late 1919, he had Wilkins' photographs pasted into large albums. He worked on them, and with scientific precision, he plotted key geographic features, angles and distances, and the location of specific units and military objectives across the surface of the photographs. As he wrote the account of Australians at War, he used these photographs taken by Hubert Wilkins as primary reference. Bean knew that his written version of any event must be congruent with the geography of the landscape. Words and images have to match, and he never relied solely on one source. As he wrote up the relevant part of his history, he checked eyewitness statements against a photograph. The image provided him with visual evidence to confirm people's accounts, and it served as a framework on which to reconstruct a story. In this particular case, Bean was assessing how far Australians had advanced on the first day. Charles Bean had always considered art to be a central component of the future museum, as it had the capacity to unite strong storytelling with very powerful symbolism. In 1922, when the fledgling Australian War Memorial put up temporary displays in Melbourne, an important feature was a massive painting by George Lambert of the Anzac landing at Gallipoli. This painting had always been imagined as the centrepiece of the Gallipoli displays. With such a broad canvas to work on, Lambert positioned important stages of the story across the painting. Starting in the lower left corner, he showed the Australians landing on the beach in the half-light of dawn. The struggle of individuals through the low, spiky undergrowth. A young boy dying as others rush past him. And then the scramble up the steep slopes and the rush across Puggy's Plateau. Lambert fashioned the painting so that the attention of viewers would be drawn back towards the left-hand side by the bursting artillery shell, and then down the rugged ridge lines back to the beach. In fact, it's quite a circular composition. Indeed, it was a very unconventional composition for the time, and it challenged viewers. And Lambert also deliberately painted the bodies and the earth in the same time, making them nearly indistinguishable in the dawn light. From his own experience walking the ground at Gallipoli, Lambert knew that the earth had literally swallowed up many of these men and obliterated their identity. Lambert's picture brought together elements of the Gallipoli story in ways that other visual material and objects just couldn't. Its focus on the harsh and difficult terrain, rather than on hand-to-hand combat, further cemented the idea that the real enemy to overcome was the landscape. The painting was a huge success. It captured the entire sweep of the story, and the enormous canvas created a dramatic and emotional experience for veterans and their families. On Anzac Day 1924, a photograph of it was featured in a Melbourne newspaper. It showed a museum worker explaining the picture to a young boy, and the accompanying caption noted how the imperishable memory of the deeds of Australian soldiers would be passed on to Australian youth to be maintained in peace, or if need be, in war. Many items collected by the historical mission or created as a result of it remain central and iconic features of the Australian War Memorial. And these things are seen by nearly a million visitors every year. Lambert's paintings, produced as part of his commission with the historical mission, are still featured in the Gallipoli Gallery. Alongside them are examples of Wilkins' photographs taken on the peninsula in 1919. Objects picked up by the historical mission as they walked the ground are also on view. They include the logs retrieved from Lone Pine, and one of the salvaged lifeboats is in the first gallery of the memorial. Gathered from the beaches, trenches, ridges and valleys around the Anzac area, these are all part of the evidence collected to help answer some of those riddles that Charles Vane proposed. But just as he hoped it would, the collection has become also a lasting memorial to the tragedy of war, as well as to the achievements and sacrifices of members of the NIF. Australian attitudes to the Gallipoli campaign and to war in general have changed dramatically since the time of the Australian Historical Mission. Since then, the critical elements of the Anzac story have constantly been examined and reinterpreted by historians, politicians and cultural commentators. Yet visitors to the memorial still find relevance and meaning in the Gallipoli displays. For nearly a century, the rich and varied collection of material assembled for the nation by the Historical Mission has been made accessible to public visitors, museum curators, historians, researchers, authors and publishers. Like all primary source material, the collection will always be open to interpretation and open to the construction of fresh meanings. But as Australians' attitudes to war, and in particular to the Gallipoli campaign, shift with time, the wealth of material collected by the Australian Historical Mission will continue to be reinterpreted for new generations and new times. Thank you.
Many thanks, Dr. Gooding. So we come to questions and discussion. You've told us about the Dean mission and the photographer and the artist who accompanied him. What about your own mission that led to this book? Tell us about how this book came about. Just talk to the end of the room.
Okay.
I arrived at the War Memorial in 2005 and was offered an opportunity to work on an exhibition. And I was offered two choices. Would you like to work on a George Lambert exhibition? Would you like to work on a Sidney Nolan exhibition? And I chose Mr. Lambert. And part of the research for Lambert exposed the historical mission, which is in fact a wonderful and rarely heard story about Australians and the work immediately after the war. And so out of the research for the exhibition, a greater research project related to the historical mission developed. And in 2007, I visited Gallipoli and I walked the ground where these guys had been, which was really important. I think most historians would agree that you need to be able to see the places that artists are painting or photographers are painting. All art and all photography is a construction. People choose to put in and they choose to leave out. And so as a historian, you need to understand what they leave out just as importantly as what they put in. And very fortunately, I had a great deal of support from the War Memorial and was able to bring together a book which explores that topic.
Before we go to the next question, I should have said that Janet Grundy's got some copies of Gallipoli Revisited outside, and I'm sure Dr. Gooding would be happy to sign them. Okay, so, yeah.
Sort of a double-barrel question. Did they do this anywhere else, like in Europe? Was it only Gallipoli? And to what extent was this kind of expedition the reason that we focused so strongly on Gallipoli to the exclusion of the other heroic and hugely more important contributions, which are only now being brought forward for students to think about in terms of the First World War? I mean, we had this overemphasis on Gallipoli, and they're marvellous to put those things in the memorial, but it really looks like that was the reason why we were so focused on Gallipoli.
I wouldn't say the historical mission's the culprit there. The Australian War Records section set up in late 1916 actually documented everywhere Australians fought. So the Western Front had huge documentary programs there. The same sort of photography was being done at the time of the battles, and also in the Middle East there was a War Records section there. The difference with Gallipoli was that it had been abandoned and there had not been official records, really, substantial records kept at the time. And all of those riddles still remain to be solved. And that's why the historical mission, its primary job was to gather evidence so that Australians could try and understand what had happened. It had been such a terrible disaster. The landscape, they had never reached the points that they had been meant to reach even on the first day, let alone after 8 months. No one had ever seen the Dardanelles. These were all things that remained absolutely central in people's who had been involved in that campaign. Questions and stories that needed to be answered. So I don't think that is why there is such an emphasis on Gallipoli.
Go there and come here. Yes.
I'm just wondering, the historical mission was here for such a very brief time. Is there much in the records relating to the war graves work which adds or embellishes the work that's been uncovered in terms of the battles on the peninsula?
Just come back and speak.
The war graves unit is just an amazing group. Most of them were volunteers doing that work. They were a subset of the Imperial War Graves Unit, so a London-based agency, really, set up, I think, in 1916 or 17 on the Western Front. Their records are not in Australia. Their records are in Britain. But the leader of the Australian unit was Cyril Hughes, a Tasmanian, a very highly decorated man. And he and Bean, of course, had known each other during the war, and there was a great correspondence and great friendship between the key members of the Graves Unit and the Historical Mission for years to come. Yeah. They did the most amazing work in identifying people and reinterring everyone. It was quite extraordinary.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not an expert, but in my opinion, one of the greatest commanders in the Second World, the First World War, was a colonial, an Australian, a Jew, the son of German Jews, not part of the regular army, an engineer at Monash. Now, I believe that he was very successful and it is tribute to Australian democracy and Australian meritocracy that he got to such a high position in the army in Australia. And it seems to me that, and I'm wrong with this, that Beam and Murdoch diminished his role.
Well, this probably goes a bit beyond
arts and
photography.
Beam and Monash were in close proximity through 1917 and 18, and you can read the official histories. You can also read Bean's correspondence for commentary. But you know, Bean is just one person in that mix, and I haven't really explored that connection. I can't help there.
Okay.
But as you know, Monash was on Gallipoli.
Yes.
But his greatest achievement, of course, was late.
Yes, question there again. Yeah.
It seems remarkable how soon after the war the Australians could go to Turkey and were welcomed by the Turks.
Absolutely.
It's an
amazing story. That last photograph of the mission group, there is in fact a Turkish officer in the group, and Bean was insistent that to get the full story as much as possible that they should have a Turkish advisor with them. To tell them where the Turkish troops had been deployed, what they'd done, their side of the story. He believed that you can't write history from a single perspective, you need multiple perspectives. So they invited the Turkish authorities to send a representative, and they sent Major Zaki Bey, a high-ranking officer who had served on Gallipoli from the first day, and in fact had faced Australian troops on many occasions. And Zaki Bey stayed with the group for about a week, and Zaki Bey spoke French, and Bean spoke some French, and they sort of parleyed through language and walked the ground together. It was, as you say, truly remarkable. It was only a matter of months since the end of the war.
Did Bean have any champions in the military or the political establishment? Or did he need any champions, or did he just do it himself?
He was incredibly well-connected.
Yeah.
He was really well-connected. He was far more than a correspondent, really. He was so well-connected, he had high government support from, I think, Senator Pearce, who was the Minister for Defence at the time. He escorted Hughes around the battlefield, so he had access to the Prime Minister. He certainly had access to all the commanders. They considered he was a confidant and released official orders and advised him of operations coming up. So incredibly well connected. But he did have a pretty tough fight to get the War Memorial established.
If you're going to take that question, I think I'm a bit unfair here. I mean, if you're going to take that question, he didn't like Monash from Gallipoli time. So what do you find there? He was well connected, but he used his connections to oppose Monash.
Yes, but I don't exactly understand the entire context of why he did that. You can find those comments in his diaries, which are available on the internet at the moment, they're online, and he does make some quite stinging comments about Monash, but I don't understand all of the military context for that.
There's a question down the back, yeah?
Yes, I think his late wife, Andrew Peter, apologised, felt he'd done the wrong thing by Monash.
She
said so.
Oh, okay.
My question was about the
nation. Absolutely.
Did the Turks undertake anything correspond to the Australian
Post? Not as far as I know. Their records are very hard to access. In fact, there are big research projects at the moment to translate and make them more accessible. I don't believe they had any coordinated collection of information as the historical mission did.
Question. Ellen, yes.
Have you spoken to any of the descendants of the people, of the key people? Are there any descendants?
There are two members of the Bean family. We've had some correspondence with them. But Lambert's family returned to Britain when he died in 1930. And Wilkins, I don't know if you know Wilkins' story, but he was a great explorer and aviator and huge, huge adventurer. He actually lived in America. His archives in the States. So, no, it's quite difficult to talk to those people. I have met descendants of some of the Seventh Light Horse people who were with the Gallipoli Mission.
Then we had a battle to get it all going in the museum. I would have thought Billy Hughes would have been fairly supportive. You said Senator Pierce was. What was Billy Hughes' attitude in all this? Because he had this great role in the First World War and he was a little bigger and he had a great international moment.
Yes.
So can you fill us in on the details of how it happened?
You know, at the time when Bean was proposing the museum towards the end of the First World War, that was fine. But in the post-war years, there was in fact a movement to not celebrate the war, to not build edifices to it. And then the Depression came, and a combination of factors made it very, very difficult to get the museum a building. It had displays in Melbourne, and it had displays here in Sydney for some years, but to get a home for the collection was very difficult. And the Australian War Memorial in Canberra was actually opened in 1941, so in the middle of the Second World War. So just a number of things kept preventing it coming to sort of resolution.
Right down the back here.
It's one of the slides that indicated the number of costs that were invaders, and invaders being Christians in that sort of symbolism. Were
being
land regarded as,
you know, yeah, it's a really interesting question. Politically, in the terms of a treaty, in just at the end of the war, the sites, the cemeteries of the Allied personnel, the Australians, Brits, and the Indians, were designated. Under the authority of the Imperial War Graves Commission. So from the very first, they were seen as sites that would be maintained by the War Graves Authority in perpetuity. I think in the 70s, the peninsula, and particularly the fighting areas around Anzac, was designated a peace park. And now it is... There is a number of new memorials that have gone on to the Gallipoli Peninsula, Turkish memorials, and the Turkish have reclaimed much of that landscape, that visual landscape, and it has huge Turkish visitation. It's a central part of their commemoration of nation building, as someone mentioned.
Because what, as you know, what you're dealing about was not the defeat of Turkey, but the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, so... I suppose that corresponds with the establishment of modern Turkey under Ataturk, so...
That's right, and that was in the early 20s, I believe, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, before we go, is there any... Yep?
Well, it wasn't until 1963 when I was in the United States and meeting up about Anzac Day that I realised there were other troops, Gallipoli, apart from the Australians and New Zealanders, apart from the French were there.
Yes.
And apart from the Brits, well, no one knew they were there, don't know the wrong thing. But I'm just wondering if, how many other troops were there that we never, ever heard about.
It was a very big contingent, and I think there were certainly very large numbers of French down in the south fighting at Cape Helles, and Indians, Australians, Canadians, and British. So it's combined.
You never know that, do you?
Yes, who you are.
And
yes, exactly.
And don't forget the New Zealanders. Just talk about, we'll finish up in a minute, but your own mission there, because I don't know, if you go there today, what you're looking at when you were there in 2007, it's not dramatically different from what it would have been a lot like just before April the 25th, 1915. When you're looking at the photo, you would have taken photographs. You would have compared them with the modern, with the old photographs. How did all that work in that part of what you were doing?
The landscape. I'm particularly interested in landscape, cultural landscape. The landscape, in fact, is significantly different in that it has, from the 1970s onwards, I think, been replanted with species that are not endemic to the area. So there are cypresses and pines and things which are not native to that particular geography. The things like the roads that cut through, not the beach road so much, but other roads across the landscape, crisscross it quite significantly. It's actually very hard. The Gallipoli landscape is very hard to read. I haven't walked in the Blue Mountains here, but it feels a bit like that. It's claustrophobic, it's close, you can't actually see where you are in relation to the beach unless you're right on the beach. So it must have been an absolutely horrendous place to land and try and make your way through. You get caught down in these steep gullies and you have absolutely no idea where you're going, and it's impenetrable. So it's actually quite a hard landscape to navigate and to match up historic photos taken nearly 90 years ago with how it looks today.
Well, we're coming to the end. We'll take one question and we'll finish up here. Yeah.
It was quite a moving Turkish museum when I was there about a decade ago. Any attempts to expand that to a joint museum, a Turkish-Australian museum, the Australian War Memorial?
I believe there are a number of projects, particularly through universities, cooperating together to build those museums, to share research. Australians are putting large research grants towards translation and facilitation exchange. And places like ANU in Canberra are sort of facilitating Turkish scholars visiting all the time. But I think the museums are at this stage not exchanging objects. We often send photographs there and stuff like that. The test will be the submarine, I think. Because, of course, that will be a contentious object.
It's the AE2. Final question.
This is really about the painting. There was one there that you showed, I think it was Langer, but it was very golden. The blue mountains,
yes,
in the background. And yet the photographs, although they were black and white, didn't indicate that the place was so clay. To what extent was there a bit of artistic license? It reminded me a bit of Central Australia. Far too golden, and far, because I've been there, I know it's all been grown over and stuff, but was it as clay and as golden, or was there a little touch of the romance there?
Well, Lambert's a little bit, he's an extravagant sort of artist and personality. It was certainly much more churned up. The ground was much more churned up when they were there, and you can see photographs taken at the time to show that there would have been much more of the sort of the yellow golden clay that they talk about exposed. But definitely Lambert's paintings of Gallipoli and the large painting of the neck, which I didn't show today, have been likened to Australian landscapes. And that's one of his great sort of experiences, was the Australian landscape as well.
That's fascinating.
Many thanks. Just stay there for a second. Looks like a Lambert had put it into the wind prize, he might have won.
It's possible.
Thanks for coming along tonight. You mentioned the AE2. We'd had a lot of discussion with the AE2 over the years, and we actually helped a bit to get that underway through to help Mark Spencer, who did the initial dive on the AE2. And they're all on the Sydney papers online, all those talks. Now, your book is a very important book. It's without doubt the Australian War Memorial is one of the great museums in the world, and the collection is great, and it's wonderful to think that people like you are so active in preserving this great Australian treasure, which has been honoured by both sides of Australian politics and by the Australian people overall. So tonight, Thanks for talking about your book, Gallipoli Revisited. Janet Grundy's got some copies. It's a remarkable work because it doesn't just focus, or already focuses on the war, it focuses on how we saw the war after the war ended in 1918 through Charles Bean and his colleagues. So well done tonight. Congratulations on your work. Congratulations on your book. It's been a great talk tonight. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.